10 days before the holidays in a small Pennsylvania town. A new mother is excited by her baby's first Christmas. But when they disappear without a trace, the holiday turns tragic. Investigators suspect her husband is somehow responsible. But with little evidence, they called on the FBI to find the answers before time ran out for the missing mother and child.
The woman and her infant son vanish. The husband is frantic. The clues are scarce. But hopes linger, even as the hours and days tick by without a word. Was she on the run or the victim of foul play? I'm Jim Kallstrom, former head of the FBI's New York office. It was an investigation filled with blind alleys and dead ends. In order to go forward, we had to revisit the past.
Catasauqua, Pennsylvania, 1 hour north of Philadelphia. A quiet, blue-collar town. A safe place to raise a family. By December 15th, 1994, the town was preparing for the holiday season. The house at 740 Front Street was already decorated. Inside, 26-year-old Joanne Katrinak, happily married and a new mother, was especially excited about the holidays. It would be the first Christmas for her four-month-old son, Alex. Joanne and her mother-in-law, Veronica, planned to spend the day at a nearby mall. Now Joanne called to say that Alex was dressed and ready. They'd be right over. Joanne wanted to find the perfect gift for her husband, Andy. They'd been married less than 2 years. And though they didn't have a lot of money, Joanne had been saving for the holiday. Before Joanne had met Andy, she had had some bad relationships. Her first husband was abusive. The marriage had ended in divorce. But she was happy now. Her husband, Andy Katrinak, came home a little after 6 o'clock that evening. He was self-employed as a contractor and sometimes worked long hours. Before he'd met Joanne, Andy had been a confirmed bachelor. But it seemed that finding this kind and beautiful woman had changed his life. Usually, Joanne and Alex were waiting for him when he came home. But not tonight. That didn't seem to worry Andy. After all, it was Christmas time and the mall traffic would be heavy. He saw that Joanne had left some chicken to defrost. He settled in to relax and wait for his family. An hour went by. Then another. Still, Andy didn't seem concerned. He watched TV and drank another beer. At 8 p.m., Andy finally decided to check on his wife. His first call was to his mother, Veronica.
Hi, Mom. You seen Joanne?
He knew Joanne had planned to shop with her.
Well, it's,
But now his mother said Joanne had never come by.
No, I... Well, did you...
Nor had she answered her phone calls.
Well, no, she didn't. That's why I'm calling you, because I hadn't seen her. I hadn't heard from her yet. No. Well, what'd you guys do?
Veronica was worried. She said she and her husband, Andrew Sr., would be right over. While he waited for his parents, Andy checked the house to see if anything was amiss. In the basement, he found the door leading outside, open. A door he and Joanne never used. The lock had been pried away from the door frame. Andy immediately called the police. Two officers from the Catasauqua Police Department responded. By then, Andy's parents had arrived. Andy told police the events of the day. The shopping trip that never happened. The apparent disappearance of Joanne and little Alex.
Taken this year.
He claimed they had been abducted. And officers agreed that was a possibility. But it was also plausible that Joanne had left on her own and taken her child with her.
Well, yeah.
Or maybe Andy had somehow been involved.
She didn't hear from her. She was supposed to meet with her.
Veronica described her phone call with Joanne and the subsequent calls that went unanswered.
I had my coat on and waited, and she never showed up.
Here, you guys see this?
Andy now showed police the padlock that had been broken off the basement door. But the officers were not convinced it was related to the missing mother and child. That night, Andy stayed home by the phone while his father searched the surrounding area for Joanne and Alex. At 3 a.m, Andrew Sr. had found something and brought his son to see it.
This?
Joanne's tan Toyota was backed into a spot in the parking lot of McCarty's Tavern.
What is this?
Down the street from the Katrinak's home.
That's her keys, Andy.
Inside were Joanne's keys and her small canister of mace. Again, Andy called Catasauqua police. This time, police suspected foul play. But the local force lacked the resources and experience needed to lead the investigation. So they contacted Pennsylvania state troopers for assistance. With the possibility of an abduction, Major Robert Wirtz looked to the most likely suspect, Joanne's husband, Andy Katrinak.
There was a lot of looking into the family life and looking at what Andrew did on that particular day and those sorts of things. One of the things that you're always forced to do in these types of investigations is look at family members.
State police arrived at Andy's house the next morning.
You see that right there?
Andy told them that overnight he had noticed something else, a cut phone line in the basement.
Is there a crime scene down here?
One of two separate phone lines in the house.
And I left
it. The one cut serviced the cordless phone, while the other serviced the kitchen phone. It appeared to investigators that whoever cut the line knew where to look and which one to cut. State police evidence technicians also found a partial boot print on the basement floor and tool marks on the door frame where the padlock was pried off. As crime scene technicians checked the house, they found nothing to remove suspicion from Andy. In the master bedroom, there was no indication Joanne had packed for a long trip. Andy confirmed that his wife's clothes all seemed to be in the closet, and the couple's suitcases were under the bed where he said they always kept them. Technicians found no blood or other signs of foul play. They dusted for fingerprints around the room's entry points, but found only Andy's and Joanne's. In the baby's room, There were also no signs that little Alex had been taken on a long trip, and no indication of a struggle or robbery. At the State Police Barracks garage, evidence technicians processed Joanne's car. They hoped something left behind could lead them closer to the missing mother and child. On the headrest of the driver's seat, they found six dirty blonde hairs. One was partially smeared with a dark red substance, maybe blood. But nothing immediately pointed to Joanne and Alex's whereabouts. As lead investigator, Trooper Bob Egan was suspicious of the way the car had been found.
There were a couple things that led Andy Katrinak to believe that his wife did not back that car. And number one is that she never used that parking lot to park her vehicle. They had a parking lot in back of their house. And number two, she never backed the car in. When she parked into a parking space, she always pulled in front of the vehicle first. She was very bad at backing up.
3 days had passed since Andy's wife and son disappeared. His parents posted flyers throughout his neighborhood and in Catasauqua's shopping district.
Tell me, have you seen this woman or the baby?
Anywhere Joanne and Alex
no,
might
I'm
have
sorry,
visited.
I have not.
This is a picture of our daughter-in-law. This is our grandchild.
With still no word from Joanne or a kidnapper, troopers delved further into Andy's background. They found him anxious when he spoke of his former days as a semi-pro boxer in Las Vegas. He was good with his fists and earned his living as an instructor when he first moved to Pennsylvania. Now a private contractor, Andy barely made enough to pay the bills. A wife, a house, and a baby strained the new father's resources. Troopers asked to see his financial records, including insurance documents, bank statements, and phone records.
I got some checks.
He told them that his wife had only minimal life insurance.
I know you wanted, probably would have wanted phone records. I brought that down too.
On the day she disappeared with his son, Andy said he had been with his father building a room addition for a client who lived a few miles from his home. Troopers were not satisfied. They suspected he may have still been hiding something. They demanded that Andy take a polygraph test.
Right now, do you know where your wife is located?
No, I don't.
The first test showed that Andy had not been deceptive regarding his family's disappearance. But investigators needed to be sure.
No.
Did you
so they tested him again.
No, I didn't.
The results were conclusive.
No.
Andy was telling the truth about his missing wife and baby. Investigators cleared the husband as a suspect.
No, I'm not.
By now, Joanne and Alex had been missing for 4 days, and investigators still had no solid leads. Whether it had been a desertion or an abduction, it was possible the woman and child had crossed state lines. On December 19, 1994, state police called on the FBI for help. Special Agent Dave Rowe from the FBI's Allentown office joined the effort.
We began our investigation by identifying, locating, and interviewing virtually all of the relatives, virtually all of the friends, former work colleagues, anybody and everybody who was either related to or acquainted with Andy, Joanne, and Alex.
Open. Coffee?
Yes, thank you.
Local, state, and federal agencies funneled their resources into the search for the missing woman and child. 6 days before Christmas, it seemed as if they had vanished without a trace. Joanne Katrinak, a 26-year-old mother, and her 4-month-old son, Alex, had mysteriously disappeared from their Catasauqua, Pennsylvania home. Her husband, Andy, had been cleared of suspicion. Now investigators traveled across Pennsylvania state lines to question Joanne's ex-husband, who lived and worked in New Jersey. Mike Jack had married Joanne in 1991. They were divorced just a few months later amidst allegations that Jack was abusive. Maybe Joanne had decided to rekindle the relationship. Or perhaps your ex had come to win her back. But investigators found Jack had a solid alibi for the date of Joanne's disappearance. Agents also pursued people from Andy's past.
What are you doing here?
Well,
including his ex-girlfriend, Pat Rohrer.
December 14th.
Anything wrong?
An FBI agent interviewed Rohrer at her home in North Carolina.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I keep all
he found she, too, had a solid alibi for the day Joanne and Alex had vanished.
I'll tell you what, I really appreciate that, man.
Okay.
Back in Catasauqua, investigators returned to McCarty's Tavern, where Joanne's car had been found the day she had disappeared. Maybe someone had noticed her, or whoever had parked the car. Troopers and agents eventually interviewed everyone who had been at the bar that night. But no one had seen a thing.
Were you working last Thursday night?
Yes, I was.
Investigators also canvassed the Katranack neighborhood. One neighbor directed them to a handyman who rented a room down the street. He'd done repair work at several local homes. Detectives soon discovered he had a criminal record for breaking and entering. He seemed a promising suspect. He admitted to police he had had some run-ins with the law, but swore he had no knowledge of Joanne and Alex's disappearance. He agreed to come in for further questioning. Investigators learned the handyman lived in a lean-to by a river near the Katranack's house during the summer months. A state police canine team searched the shelter for any evidence that Joanne and Alex had been there. They found nothing. And the handyman was cleared. Another dead end. For frustrated investigators, precious time slipped away as community concern grew.
Come in.
State Police Major Robert Wirtz helped establish hotlines to elicit the public's help.
There was obviously a lot of concerns in the community as to what occurred. So we had a command post set up here at the barracks, with a number of telephone lines coming into the command post. Those phone numbers were given to the public, and we in fact did get information from the public.
Reports of sightings poured in. One resident reported seeing Joanne with an unidentified man near railroad tracks behind the Katranack's home. She was carrying a baby and seemed frightened by the man pulling her further into the brush against her will. In response, FBI agents and state police immediately conducted a massive line search of a four-mile stretch near the railroad tracks. The search continued through the night. They scanned the area inch by inch as choppers circled overhead. But again, investigators found nothing. Trooper Joe Kosovar, now co-lead investigator with his partner Bob Egan, recalls that reports of sightings continued.
They saw her along the railroad tracks. They saw her on an airplane. They saw her in a convenience store with a baby. But none of them checked out. They were false leads, and apparently people who they saw and thought they saw were two different people.
Christmas passed and spring began, with still no word of Joanne and Alex. Then on April 9th, a farmer was tilling his field in Heidelberg Township, 15 miles northwest of Catasauqua. he saw what looked like a pile of clothes at the field's edge. When he walked over to investigate, he encountered a horrifying sight. Human remains. Disappearance of Joanne Katrinak and her infant son, Alex. A farmer found the decaying bodies of a mother and child at the edge of his Pennsylvania field. The FBI and troopers arrived immediately. Dental records would later confirm what they already suspected. The bodies were Alex and Joanne Katrinak's. Joanne lay on her back, a diaper bag still on her shoulder. She had been shot once in the head and beaten about the face. Alex was face down on his mother's stomach, dressed in the blue snowsuit he'd worn on his ill-fated trip to meet his grandmother. The bodies were 50 feet past the end of a trail that ran through the woods. Nearby, crime scene technicians found a baby bottle and a rattle. To Trooper Bob Egan, the location of the items was significant.
You could see items that had fallen to the ground almost in a sequence as if an assault started and Joanne was walking or running away from the assault and she was dropping items along the way.
It appeared the killer had driven up to the end of the trail and from there had forced Joanne to walk the remaining 50 feet. Evidence technicians would spend 15 hours searching the area, but they found no shell casings, fingerprints, footprints, or murder weapons. In the hopes that the forest debris might yield answers, they collected leaves and dirt from beneath the bodies and sent them to the police lab for closer examination. For Major Robert Wirtz and the others who'd worked the case for months, the finality of this brutal murder evoked a barrage of emotions.
When the bodies were found, there was a period of time there when it was very difficult for the officers that were assigned to this investigation. Took it very personally, and it was hard because I think they were holding out hope that, you know, she was going to be found alive.
With the mysterious disappearance officially deemed a homicide, the case remained under state jurisdiction. But the FBI never stopped actively assisting.
Hello, Linda. Dave Rowe here.
The fact that somebody would abduct a new mother and a four-month-old infant, everybody can identify with that. And once you become aware of that, you want to be part of the investigation.
An autopsy revealed that Joanne had been shot once with a .22 caliber bullet and beaten 19 times with a blunt object. The fact that there had been two modes of attack was a telling clue for Trooper Joe Kosovar.
Based on the absence of empty shell casings, and the fact that the victim had received one shot and numerous blows to the head led me to believe that the gun malfunctioned.
The medical examiner was unable to determine exactly how baby Alex was killed, whether he'd been suffocated or left to die of exposure. Police continued to analyze the physical evidence found at the crime scene. To help build the case, they brought in prosecutor Mike McIntyre of the Lehigh County District Attorney's Office.
We found two more hairs that first match the six hairs found on that headrest in color and length.
But the hairs would have to be examined forensically to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they matched. A Pennsylvania State Police forensic scientist conducted the lab analysis. The results confirmed what investigators had suspected. The hairs belonged to the same person. And the substance on one of them was determined to be human blood, containing DNA consistent with Joanne's. But to whom did the hairs belong? Tests quickly ruled out the Katranaks and several of Joanne's friends who had access to the car. Pennsylvania State Police were baffled.
How far are we on?
Again, they turned to the FBI for help. The FBI sent a behavioral profiler from Washington, D.C. A profiler can help narrow the search for suspects by detailing the type of person responsible for a crime through that person's behavioral characteristics. Profilers study a variety of crime-related information, including case reports, geography, timing, and the victim's habits. Then they revisit the crime scenes to read the locations for clues to the killer's behavior. Investigators first took the profiler to the place the bodies were found. He would look for anything that might reveal the killer's signature. The area was so far from the abduction site, the profiler was convinced the killer had been here before. The profiler also hypothesized the killer had been male because the attack had been so brutal. The abduction had taken place in broad daylight, which offered another hint. The killer would be someone comfortable being seen in the small town of Catasauqua, and someone who perhaps knew the family's habits and the layout of the house. By fleshing out this portrait of the killer, the profiler gave investigators new direction in a frustrating case. But troopers needed a name that fit the profile. To find that name, troopers drove Andy around Heidelberg Township, close to where the bodies were found. They hoped to prompt his memory of someone who knew this rural area. They asked if Joanne had ever visited here. Was there a friend or a family member who lived nearby? Andy could think of no one. Disappointed, investigators returned to State Police headquarters. Then, just as Andy was about to leave, he remembered something. He did know someone who knew Heidelberg Township and also his home in Catasauqua. His ex-girlfriend, Pat Rohrer, had once managed a stable in Heidelberg.
And with that, he tells me that he couldn't tell me the exact place, what it was called, because he couldn't remember the name, but he could give me directions on how to get there. So I told him, I said, well, tell me. As he started to tell me the directions of how to get to where Patty Rohrer was boarding a horse and taking care of horses, well, I knew he was taking me right to the area where Joanne and the baby were found.
We used to go together.
Pat Rohrer and Andy had lived together briefly in Pennsylvania. He told investigators he once visited her at the stable. But they'd broken up in 1989, and she had moved back to North Carolina.
How you been? Yeah? It's all right.
Then in the spring of 1991, before Andy met Joanne, Rohrer had visited him unexpectedly after a fight with her most recent boyfriend. Andy was sympathetic. He let Rohrer stay for a few days, though their relationship remained purely a friendship.
So, tell me about it.
Then she returned to North Carolina.
Fresno Road.
Not long after that, Andy met Joanne.
We lived together for a while.
As he now told state troopers, it was love at first sight.
You know.
They were married soon after, in the spring of 1993. They agreed they wanted children, and less than a year later, Joanne was pregnant.
Hey, sweetie.
Hi, baby.
Alex was born in August of 1994.
That you think is so adorable? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what I think it's all.
Now Andy told investigators about something that had happened 3 days before his wife and son disappeared.
I will. Hello?
On December 12th, Joanne answered a phone call.
May I tell him it's
It was Pat Rohrer.
It's her. Pat.
What does she want?
What do you think she wants?
Joanne told Rohrer that Andy was married now and that they had a baby. She told Rohrer not to call again.
Please, don't call us.
Then Joanne hung up on her.
I used to date a girl.
Though Andy knew Pat had a temper, he dismissed the idea that she might seek revenge. Then the investigation took an unexpected turn. A second mother and child were found brutally murdered. The pair, who resembled Joanne and Alex, were discovered in a retail store dressing room in nearby Collegeville, Pennsylvania. Investigators now wondered if a serial killer was on the loose, preying on mothers and children in Pennsylvania. While investigating the homicide of Joanne and Alex Katranak, Pennsylvania State Police responded to another double murder in a retail store just 45 miles away. The victims were a second young mother and her baby. Police feared a serial killer was on the prowl. They quickly arrested the suspect, the store owner's son. While he confessed to this killing, he had an airtight alibi for the day Joanne and Alex were slain. Now police turned their attention to Andy Katranak's ex-girlfriend, Pat Rohrer.
Yeah, we got a couple things to run down.
Rohrer was a long shot, a brunette instead of a blonde, and a woman, though the profiler believed the murderer was male. But she was familiar with both the abduction and murder sites. Then Trooper Joe Kosovar recalled that he'd worked on a case that was strangely similar. He phoned Special Agent Dave Rowe.
Trooper Joe Kosovar recollected that he had investigated a homicide some years earlier where the cause of death was blunt force blows to the head. The assailant was determined to be a woman. While 1, 2, 3, 4 blows by an adult male would produce the same damage that a woman might have to strike 15, 20, 25 blows to accomplish.
Joanne Katranak had sustained 19 blows. But could a woman have killed her and her infant as well? In May of 1995, 6 months after the murders, Troopers Bob Egan and Joe Kosovar traveled to North Carolina. The FBI had helped coordinate a meeting with the Lexington County Sheriff's Office. Together, authorities from the two states would interview Pat Rohrer at her attorney's office. Rohrer's mother was also there.
You exercise the horses, can you tell us?
Rohrer expanded upon her original alibis. On December 15th, the day of the crime, she said she'd visited a local tanning salon. That evening, she'd taken her regular Thursday night dance lesson at the Cowboys Nightlife Bar.
Why'd you guys split up?
Rohrer admitted she'd worked at the stable in Heidelberg Township, but said she hadn't been back to Pennsylvania since she'd visited Andy after the fight with her boyfriend. She also swore she'd never owned a gun. Lieutenant Tony Roberson of the Lexington County Sheriff's Department helped agents and troopers investigate her statements.
The first thing that they wanted to do was discredit her alibis to find out whether they could be corroborated or whether they could be found to be invalid.
Excuse me, ma'am.
Investigators visited the tanning salon Rohrer claimed to have used on the day of the murders. Prosecutor Mike McIntyre remembers this alibi quickly proved false.
The owner of the tanning salon, Mrs. Simerson, said, hey, you know what? Something's wrong here, because we were closed on that particular day that Pat Rohrer says she was in getting a tan, because that's my husband's birthday, and we were over at the shopping mart in some city about 50 miles away, and I remember that, and I hear I have a receipt for you from the shopping mall to show that we were there.
Sir.
At the Cowboys Nightlife Bar, the dance instructor knew Rohrer as a regular.
We're investigating a murder up in Pennsylvania, and we understand that...
The club's sign-in sheet showed she'd been there the Thursday before December 15th and the Thursday after, but not on the 15th. Investigators secured Rohrer's phone records. They showed she'd used the phone every day of December 1994, except from the 12th through the 15th. Despite her alibis, Rohrer could not prove she'd been in North Carolina on the day of the killings. More incriminating still, her police record revealed a history of violence.
She has violent tendencies, has had them in the past. She was charged in a neighboring county in Forsyth County of getting into a fight over a man at a bar. And she was arrested that night.
But investigators were still missing one key piece of evidence, the murder weapon. Rohrer continued to deny she'd ever owned a gun. But investigators kept digging. At a North Carolina stable, they found one of her ex-boyfriends, Walter Blaylock. He distinctly remembered that Rohrer had bought a handgun for $50 at a yard sale. It was a .22 caliber Jennings, which they had used for target shooting in Rohrer's backyard.
You put your hands on me, girl.
The last time he had seen it was during an intense argument. Now Blaylock told Trooper Egan the gun had a curious flaw.
He went on to describe the handgun as being a junky piece of junk type of handgun that often after the first time you shot it, it jammed, not allowing you to fire a second shot. Now this fed into the theory why somebody would be shot once and then beaten about the head.
The FBI helped coordinate interstate efforts to secure a probable cause warrant to search Rohrer's North Carolina home for the murder weapon. They arrived with the warrant on July 24th,
1995. Have a warrant, search
your house, man. What are you doing
here? Have a warrant.
Despite a thorough search, they didn't find the gun. But they did find numerous spent .22 caliber shell casings in the backyard.
State police. Detective Egan, Detective Kosovar, ma'am.
Only when police told Rohrer that they knew she owned a handgun did she admit to it.
I have this gun in my house.
But she insisted Blaylock had taken it with him when he'd moved out about a month before the murders.
No, I have not.
Why did you buy the gun?
I told you.
The case against Rohrer was growing, but it was built on circumstantial evidence.
Just because he wanted this gun.
Did she hit it? She dumped it.
And strangely, the only physical evidence, the hairs from the car and the murder site, didn't seem to fit. The hairs were dirty blonde. Rohrer's hair was brown. Trooper Joe Kosovar wondered if it could have been dyed at the time of the killings. He learned that shortly before the murders, Rohrer had ridden in a rodeo competition and won. Kosovar contacted the event organizers, hoping they'd taken a photo of her. His inquiry paid off. They sent him the photo. As he'd guessed, Rohrer's hair was dirty blonde.
The photograph was given to our crime lab personnel, and they compared the color of the photograph of the hair with the color of the hairs that were found in the vehicle and decided that they should further investigate those hairs.
Detectives obtained a warrant to collect blood and hair samples from Pat Rohrer. If evidence analysts could match her hair to those from Joanne's car on the murder site, the troopers could make their arrest. But they would need to rely on a test so new that it would take more than a year for the test to be approved. Until then, the prime suspect of the double murder would remain free. After an investigation that had lasted almost a year, detectives had a strong suspect in the double murder of Joanne Katrinak and her infant son, Alex. With a search warrant, they obtained blood and hair samples from Pat Rohrer, the former girlfriend of Joanne's husband, Andy. Rohrer was now pregnant with the child of her current boyfriend. Forensic scientists would attempt to match her hair samples with hair found at the crime scenes. The Pennsylvania State Police Lab determined Rohrer's hairs were microscopically consistent with the recovered hairs. But investigators needed more proof, a match at the cellular level. They extracted Rohrer's DNA sequence from her blood samples and attempted to compare it with the DNA and hairs from the crime scenes. But there was a problem making a match. Joseph DiZino, unit chief of the DNA analysis unit 2 at the FBI lab, explains.
When hairs are found at a crime scene, they're normally naturally shed hairs that don't have much tissue upon their root. And if they don't have much tissue upon the root, there's very, very little DNA contained in those hairs. And therefore, our experience has shown us that nuclear DNA analysis will fail.
In this case, only one of the hairs found at the crime scene contained enough skin tissue necessary for nuclear DNA analysis. But there was a great risk. To conduct the test, examiners would have to destroy that sample. If the test was inconclusive, there was no way to repeat the process. They needed a way to test the other hairs that held no skin tissue. A possible solution lay in a new process being pioneered by the FBI lab in Washington, D.C. Mitochondrial DNA testing.
This was brand new. To my knowledge, this was the first forensics laboratory in the United States to bring this new analysis online.
Because the test was so new, it would take more than a year to be certain the results could be scientifically reliable. Mitochondrial DNA testing uses the DNA contained in the cell's mitochondria, or organelles. Since there is more mitochondrial DNA than nuclear DNA in hair cells, it is easier for examiners to retrieve the mitochondrial DNA. With 5 hair samples to test, examiners could repeat the test and obtain more reliable results.
With mitochondrial DNA analysis, we're over 90% successful obtaining DNA from hairs that are naturally shed, hairs without root. And we only need about 1 inch of hair in order to obtain a result, generally speaking.
To attempt a mitochondrial DNA match, first the DNA sequence in a hair cell's mitochondria is isolated. Then its sequence is plotted and compared to the suspect's known DNA sequence. In this case, taken from Pat Rohrer's blood cells. Both DNA sequences matched. Forensic scientist Joseph DiZino explains what that meant.
If a hair from a crime scene is found to have the same mitochondrial DNA type as a blood sample from a suspect, our reports state that that suspect cannot be excluded as a source of that hair from the crime scene. Therefore, Patricia Rohrer could not be excluded as a source of these hairs.
However, without nuclear DNA confirmation, the result was not absolutely conclusive. Now scientists examined the hair sample with skin for a nuclear DNA match. It corroborated the mitochondrial match. There was no question that Patricia Rohrer had left those hairs behind. It was a pivotal moment in the case. In the early morning of June 24, 1997, investigators arrived at Rohrer's home with an arrest warrant.
Pat Rohrer?
I've got a warrant for your arrest. I need you to come with us, please.
Yes.
Deputy, go with him.
A female detective followed Rohrer upstairs to keep an eye on her as she dressed herself and her 18-month-old daughter. It seemed a routine safety precaution, but it yielded some of the most damaging evidence in the case.
During the time that Pat was trying to settle her baby down and get dressed, the female detective, Suzanne Pearson, was present in the bedroom. And it was at this time that she overheard a conversation that Pat Rohrer had with her baby. Pat's baby's name is Nicole. And what the detective overheard was Pat Rohrer saying to Nicole, Nicole, if I would have known I was going to get caught, I would have never brought you into this world. It was something that Suzanne Pearson, the detective, documented as soon as possible. And this was very damaging.
More than 3 years after the murder of Joanne Katranak and her baby, Pat Rohrer was finally under arrest. She was flown to Pennsylvania to face murder charges. Preparing for trial, prosecutors pieced together the terrifying events of Joanne and Alex Katranak's last day. On December 15th, 1994, Pat Rohrer had broken into the basement of the Katranak's home, knowing Andy was out and Joanne was alone with Alex. Joanne had no idea Rohrer was downstairs as she called her mother-in-law and packed up baby Alex for a shopping trip.
Right.
From the basement, Rohrer heard every word Joanne said.
All right, I'll see you in a bit. Bye.
And she remembered the house from a visit with Andy 3 years earlier. She knew where to look for the two phone lines and which one to cut so Joanne couldn't call for help. Joanne carried Alex outside, still unaware that Pat was in the house. Rohrer heard Joanne leave and went outside to catch up with her. Joanne didn't see Rohrer sneak up behind her, carrying a .22 caliber Jennings.
Oh my God! Get in the car! Oh my God! Get in the car!
Rohrer jumped into the back seat with the baby and forced Joanne to drive. Joanne must have been terrified as she drove with Rohrer's gun at her head, afraid for herself, and more so for her helpless 4-month-old baby. Rohrer directed Joanne to an obscure horse trail in Heidelberg Township. Forced her further into the woods. Joanne, in her terror, dropped Alex's rattle and then his bottle. Rohrer fired once, but then her gun jammed, and she began bludgeoning Joanne. She may have suffocated baby Alex, or simply left him to die slowly of exposure to the December elements. Then Rohrer parked the car at McCarty's Tavern and fled from Pennsylvania. Prosecutors built an airtight case using evidence investigators had meticulously collected. It was a concerted effort by many in law enforcement, unwilling to let this woman and child perish in silence.
As investigators, we have a responsibility, and that responsibility is to be the voice of the victim, is to gather the information and speak for the victims that can no longer speak.
Close six.
The jury found Pat Rohrer guilty of 2 counts of kidnapping and 2 of first-degree murder. She was sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole. Legally, the case was closed, and for the town of Catasauqua, the mystery was solved. If not for the advanced forensic technology of the FBI, this brutal double murderer might still be free. Organized crime tore through the suburbs of Chicago, leaving violence and corruption in its wake. Prominent officials were seduced by greed and power, doing whatever was necessary to protect their interests.
Business going
Everyone
good.
Was on the take.
FBI search warrant.
It would fall on the FBI to weed out the corruption and to find the killer of an innocent woman.
Springs, Illinois seemed like any other quiet Midwestern community, but it was really one of the most corrupt places in the nation. This tiny village nestled just outside of Chicago was in the hip pocket of organized crime. I'm Jim Kallstrom, former head of the FBI's New York office. It was only a matter of time before corruption led to assassination and conspiracy. To end it required a federal sting operation of astounding complexity.
The bank of a sanitary canal in a remote industrial area became the site of a gruesome crime. The killers were quick and thorough. Nearby, two police officers were out on night patrol. When they heard the shots fired, they became alarmed. One of the officers drove towards the canal to investigate. He found nothing as he searched the desolate area.
Well, hey, Chief.
Also on the scene is Willow Springs, Illinois Police Chief Michael Corbett.
I heard it earlier myself, and I've already checked the area, so...
He, too, saw nothing.
I got a cup.
The following day, a prominent local attorney called police to report that his wife was missing.
Well, Mr. Masters, we'd like to ask a few questions about your wife.
Lieutenant Howard Vanek of the Cook County Sheriff's Department and his partner responded to the call. Attorney Alan Masters said that his wife Diane had been out the night before with colleagues and friends from a local college where she worked. She never came home. There was no sign of her yellow Cadillac. He said he made calls trying to locate her until 2 in the morning, but finally gave up. For the officers, the information offered little insight.
Excuse me a minute.
Lieutenant James Keating of the Cook County Sheriff's Department joined the officers.
Yeah, by all means, you can sit down.
Sir, we were just asking Mr. Masters questions about his wife's disappearance.
He asked Masters if he could have a look around the house.
Be happy to. Sure. Yeah,
Masters agreed.
No, not at all.
He had nothing to hide. The officers continued their questioning.
Anything else you can tell us?
Reluctantly, Masters offered some new information.
Somebody works for the college.
He suspected that his wife Diane had been having an affair.
Maybe
the two lovers had run off together.
I don't know who he is or what he looks like. I just have my suspicions.
Excuse me, guys. I think we need to wrap this up.
Lieutenant Vanek wanted to investigate further and look around the house himself.
Sir, I think we need to take another look around in here.
Husbands are always suspects when their wives
disappear. I look around. There's nothing
sir, here. Sir, we need to look around.
It's time to
Something's missing here,
Let's
sir.
Go now.
But Lieutenant Keating intervened. He
sir,
wouldn't allow it.
Two investigators always check out the scene.
In his mind, everything had checked out.
Let's go now.
Vanek was upset. He didn't know why Keating would undermine his investigation. Outside, Keating confronted Lieutenant Vanek, telling him to back off.
There's no cause of precedence. There's no evidence.
As far as he was concerned, Masters was not a suspect. But Vanek didn't buy it, and he let Keating know. Just as the two men were about to explode, Willow Springs Police Chief Michael Corbett arrived at the scene.
Look, easy. Come on, guys. Supposed to be on the same side. Come on, man.
Keating would have the final word.
Hey, Vanek, you're off the case. Forget it. You're off the case, man. You got that?
The question still remained, where was Diane Masters? Her disappearance grabbed the media's attention.
And Diane, if you would, please come to the
She had been very active in the local community. Diane had worked hard to help open a shelter for battered women. She was also involved in local politics and sat on the board of the Moraine Valley Community
also,
College.
Like to present Diane with this plaque.
She did not appear to have any enemies.
All the hard work and her dedication in opening this crisis center, something that is needed desperately in this community.
But investigators began uncovering other details. It was reported by Diane's friends that her husband was controlling and abusive, and that Diane was planning to file for divorce. Assistant U.S. Attorney Tom Scorza followed the case.
We were pretty certain that what had happened here was that Diane and Alan had a regular marital dispute, sort of ordinary dispute, but that it had escalated into something much worse.
Go ahead and send him in.
Scorza's investigation soon revealed that Alan Masters was more than just a bad husband.
Hey, Al, how you doing?
It was rumored that Alan Masters had bribed local officials and police officers to secure favorable outcomes for his clients.
How'd it go?
Very well, very well. Nothing to worry about at all.
This corruption extended right to the top of law enforcement. Allegedly, Masters frequently enlisted the help of Chief Corbett.
If I don't hear about this anymore, it'll be worth every penny. Right.
It was also rumored that Masters and Chief Corbett were involved in safeguarding some of the Chicago mob's betting and prostitution rings, which were run out of show clubs throughout suburban Cook County. But investigators were focused only on Diane's disappearance. With no evidence and few leads, that investigation stalled. Unaware of Alan Masters or his wife's disappearance, the FBI had already begun an independent investigation into the mob-controlled rackets of the Chicago area. U.S. Attorney David Stettler worked with the FBI to help unravel the prostitution operation.
Okay, thanks. At that time, there were a number of topless, bottomless joints that one could go to, and many of them were undercover fronts for prostitution. So you could go in, you could watch the naked girls dancing on the stage, and for a price, you could retreat to the back, either to a booth or a back room, and engage in one form of sexual activity or another with the dancers.
The club owners knew that their customers would spend more on drinks and prostitutes if they could use their credit cards. But the patrons were reluctant. They did not want bills arriving at their homes or businesses with charges incurred from nightclubs with seedy names. The club owners found credit card transaction companies that were willing to process the charges using false but respectable business names. Special Agent Ivan Harris of the FBI's Chicago field office was assigned to help bring down the illegal businesses.
The scam was using various companies in order to launder credit cards through their business to make it appear that businessmen were actually eating at a restaurant or using a limousine service to incur the charges, when in fact they were charges for prostitution.
Larry Wright was one of the credit card transaction company owners. Wright would pick up the week's transactions from the clubs and process them through his company, National Credit Service, or NCS. One of his clients was a club owner named Joseph Marin, whose club was a front for a mob-controlled prostitution house. Wright wanted to expand his own operations. He approached Marin about setting up an illegal betting club.
She's mine. I had a chance to really interview her.
Marin was willing to help out the man who made him money. Wright would first need to pay protection money to local police in order not to be exposed and arrested.
You feel pretty confident about this guy.
Marin was the man who could arrange that protection. Wright was more than willing to pay. Marin arranged the meeting at the Willow Springs Police Department. It was to take place with Police Chief Michael Corbett. It was believed that Corbett had been handpicked by the Chicago mob boss to oversee and protect their interests in and around Willow Springs.
The word on the street, of course, was that no one could do anything in Willow Springs without the permission of the Chief of Police, Mike Corbett. The message also was from virtually anyone you would talk to that he was so powerful, that he was so well-connected, that nothing could ever be done about him.
I just want to make sure I don't get any unexpected visits.
Corbett agreed to help Larry Wright set up the new betting operation for a price.
Not quite yet.
In return, Corbett assured him he wouldn't get any heat from his officers. Larry Wright was well on his way. He returned to his office at National Credit Service, operated out of a nondescript office park location. Wright worked with two other staff members.
Doing great, Larry. Great.
But these were not ordinary employees. NCS was not just a credit card transaction service for illegal activities. It was a front for the FBI. Larry Wright was actually undercover Special Agent Larry Damron. And he and the FBI were using NCS to work their way into the heart of the corruption in Willow Springs. While local investigators struggled to unravel the disappearance of a prominent attorney's wife, the FBI had set up an undercover operation in the town of Willow Springs, just outside of Chicago. Their target, organized crime, and the corrupt police who protected them from prosecution. The undercover work was often painstaking and frustrating. FBI Special Agent Larry Damron explains the difficulties inherent in undercover work.
During the course of the undercover operation, you try to immerse yourself in what you're doing, and you try to assume that role because it's necessary for you to do that in order to accomplish anything. Oftentimes you'll hear people make comments or you'll see people do things that in any other circumstance they would be arrested for immediately. And so what you have to remember is you're in a role and you play that role out.
Damron had heard stories about how the mob resolved problems. They were swift and violent, and their signature was unmistakable. Two bullets in the head. There was no room for mistakes. Victor Spilatro, a player in Chicago's organized crime, approached Damron at NCS
Though Victor himself wielded little power, his brothers held tremendous influence within the mob's hierarchy. Damron was starting to move into the center of the violent Chicago underworld.
The Spilatros were one of the best-known names of mobsters in Chicago. The older brother, Tony, was the boss in Las Vegas. He represented the Chicago outfit for their interests in Las Vegas. Had been a prominent figure and had been widely mentioned in the papers, having been involved in murders and extortions and things like that.
Agent Damron quickly developed a reputation as an effective businessman in laundering money for mob operations.
Sure, everything's all right.
Spilatro knew of NCS's activities with the local nightclubs. They were under his control.
Really appreciate what you're doing. Good. Everything's going good with the business?
Yes, it's going great.
That's great. Good.
He told Damron he would have to pay him a cut to stay in business.
I'm glad you appreciate what we do for you.
Okay, well, that's really good.
Damron had no objection.
The level that we had there is we were paying protection to a fairly important aspect of the mob, the Spilatro family. And so that gave us a little bit of status, if you will. But we had absolutely no authority or anything like that in the mob. We were just workers, and our value was we made them money.
Agent Damron traveled to a remote hotel where he met with FBI Special Agent Gordon Brooks,
hey,
who oversaw the undercover operation. To ensure that Damron's real identity was not compromised, the two met infrequently to exchange information. Brooks vigilantly kept tabs on Damron. The investigation was as dangerous as it was complex. Not to worry about things. The agent cautiously moved forward. He wanted to continue expanding the FBI's undercover operations. He used every opportunity he could to sell the idea of opening more betting and prostitution houses throughout suburban Chicago. Even with a go-ahead from the Spilatros, Damron would still need permission and protection from the police.
To the future.
He met with nightclub owner Joseph Marin to hash out the details of the new clubs and secure police protection.
Larry, how you doing?
But there was a problem.
Look, I got some upsetting news.
What's up?
Their protector, Chief Corbett, had been removed by the Willow Springs City Council under suspicion of corruption. Marin knew another high-ranking law enforcement official who could provide the same protection as Corbett. Lieutenant James Keating, Cook County's Vice Squad Supervisor.
Tell you what, you know, he deals with me.
U.S. Attorney Tom Scorza was not surprised by the development. Keating's reputation was well known.
Okay, you feel pretty confident about this guy.
Jim Keating was a lieutenant in the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department, but if anything, the rank understated his influence. He was a very well-connected officer in a very corrupt department. He had connections with people of higher rank who were also corrupt, and so he was a key figure.
With Corbett out of the picture, the FBI shifted their focus to Keating. Damron met with him at a restaurant outside of Willow Springs.
It allows me to really concentrate on my job.
Keating said he'd have no problem helping Damron expand his operations.
One thing we need to understand is if there's a situation that comes up.
But any move Damron made would have to be approved by him.
I make the decision whether something goes down.
He warned Damron to play it straight with him and his people.
He told us that the one thing that he wouldn't tolerate was if someone double-crossed him. And he said if that happened, that they'd find us with our legs on one of the streets in the area and our head on another street in the area.
As instructed by the FBI, Damron proposed another operation, a club that would be a front for prostitution. He gave the lieutenant the first of many payments to ensure police protection.
Looks like a bonus for the guys. Huh?
Before he left, Keating said he knew someone who might be able to help him. A lawyer named Alan Masters.
And I really appreciate
Though he had no direct dealings with Alan Masters, Damron had heard the name mentioned by Chief Corbett.
Well, I knew that Masters was a well-known attorney on the south side of Chicago, that he had a tremendous reputation for being able to get things done, particularly in the local court system. And the scuttlebutt was that he wasn't reluctant to pay bribes or to deal with people however he needed to.
Damron continued his meetings with his case supervisor, Special Agent Gordon Brooks. Alan Masters. Damron needed to know everything he could about Alan Masters and his relationship with Keating and Corbett.
Now, you're in with Corbett. He's dirty.
The FBI and U.S. attorneys quickly established a hierarchy within this ring of corruption.
Okay, you're making your way up to Keating?
Right. I want you to... Corbett was the king in Willow Springs, but anytime he had to do something that involved the broader Cook County, he needed to get the permission of Keating. And Keating always had to check with the ultimate fixer, Alan Masters, to make sure everything could be handled at the court level.
I can maybe get Masters interested.
As the extent of Alan Masters' criminal activity became clearer, the FBI began looking closer at his possible role in his wife's disappearance. The two distinct cases were beginning to overlap, and Damron's objectives were broadening.
Authorities called three counties.
He was a suspect in the disappearance of his wife. It was thought that if we could develop a relationship with him, there might be something there that would come to light and might be of some benefit to that investigation.
Damron learned that Alan Masters allegedly made payoffs to several area judges in exchange for favorable decisions.
Now, we need to have that hearing on the Sanderson case. It needs to go our way. Do we have an understanding of that, Judge?
Agents speculated that Diane might have witnessed her husband's illegal activity and threatened to expose him.
I think we can come to terms with that. Right this way, sir.
Now trying to elicit information about Diane's disappearance, Damron continued his efforts to make inroads into the corruption around Willow Springs. He met with Keating several weeks later to follow up on his plan to open a show club.
A good manager lined up.
Again, Keating mentioned that his friend Alan Masters could help.
I can take care of that. He's a real fixer.
Damron took the opportunity to bring up Alan's wife. Keating said little, but then added an unusual comment.
We talked about Masters' wife turning up missing, and Keating said, well, she turned up missing like the day before the divorce was going to be filed.
That was convenient, wasn't it?
It was convenient.
And chuckled about what a good circumstance that was.
Damron was cautious not to probe too far, fearing that Keating might grow suspicious.
Okay. You've known this fellow for a long time?
Yeah.
Known him for a while. I've worked with him before.
Sure, he can do.
As the meeting ended, Keating handed over Alan Masters' phone number, saying the lawyer was expecting his call.
You won't be implicated.
I just need them each lined up. I'm going with the same.
He proceeded to set up the meeting with Alan Masters.
Hello?
Mr. Masters, how are you? This is Larry Wright speaking.
The attorney agreed to help push through all the necessary permits and legal documents, which meant bribing officials and securing protection.
Yeah, we've been working pretty hard on it for a while now.
Well, so I think it'd be
Masters suggested they get together.
Talking about,
the meeting was set for the following week, Monday, December 13th.
Okay, I'll look forward to meeting you then. I think we can maybe do some business.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.
Before the meeting would take place, however, a police officer on routine patrol near the Sanitary Canal area in Willow Springs noticed something unusual. Tire tracks led directly into the canal. He immediately called for assistance. Little did he know that the lid was about to come off the underworld in Willow Springs.
Find these trucks out here, Mark.
While the FBI continued their undercover operation in the Chicago suburb of Willow Springs, an officer out on routine patrol made an alarming discovery. Tire tracks leading directly into the sanitary canal. Police officers and a dive team responded to the site. Overseeing the investigation was James Ross, an honest cop appointed by city council to replace Michael Corbett as the police chief in Willow Springs. Though Corbett had been ousted from the department, his legacy of corruption remained. Below the surface, divers found a virtual underwater parking lot. 82 cars lined the bottom of the polluted canal. U.S. Attorney Tom Scorza believed he knew why the cars were there and who could make a profit by allowing them to be dumped without a police investigation.
Those are known as insurance give-ups, people who want to collect money on their car when the car is not worth very much anymore will find a way of losing the car and then reporting it stolen and collect the insurance. My belief was that Corbett had been the approver of all of the dumping of the cars in the Willow Springs Canal.
By nighttime, a third car had been dredged up, a yellow Cadillac. The license plate on the vehicle, DGM-19, was well known in Willow Springs. It was the tag registered to Diane Masters. Lieutenant Keating of the Cook County Sheriff's Department arrived at the scene. Chief Ross was surprised that Keating, a vice cop, had been notified. He asked Keating why he was there. Keating had no response. Officers continued examining the Cadillac. When they pried open the trunk, they discovered a decomposed body. Ross immediately ordered that the car and the body be taken back to a city garage where they could be thoroughly examined for clues. The decision not to use the police garage was well reasoned. Chief Ross knew this case potentially had far-reaching implications, and he couldn't trust his own officers. The fewer people nosing around, the better. State police began to scour the car and the body for evidence. They found 22 caliber shell casings in the trunk. The keys were still in the ignition. Eerily, the watch on the deceased body and the dashboard clock had stopped at exactly the same time, 1:50. They removed the body for further forensic investigation. The forensic team examining the body found the skull had been crushed. They also discovered 2 bullet hole entries in the left cheekbone. The bullet fragments inside the skull were removed and sent off to the FBI lab for ballistic evaluation. Dental records confirmed what everyone believed. The body found in the trunk was Diane Masters. The 9-month investigation into Diane's disappearance was now a homicide investigation.
Come on in.
Chief Ross called in Cook County Detective John Reed to work the homicide. He was to team up with the FBI, who was now taking over the murder investigation. Detective Reed was not to trust even his closest friends in the department. He was told that through the FBI undercover operation run out of NCS, law enforcement officers were being investigated for corruption. And some had ties to Alan Masters, who was now a firm suspect in Diane's murder. As Agent Harris and Detective Reed initiated their murder investigation, Agent Dameron continued his undercover operation.
Today to set up a time and place for our meeting.
He called Alan Masters to confirm their meeting to set up the show club.
I'm jammed. I expect to be in court all day tomorrow. I'm sorry.
Well, Masters was evasive and seemed distracted.
Next week's okay too, if that's okay with you.
Maybe we can work something out then. Just give me some time.
He canceled the meeting.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Wright.
Damron immediately called Keating. With the conversation being
Keating.
Recorded by the FBI, he hoped
Masters.
Keating would explain why Masters was being evasive.
No, I was wondering if you had any information on that. As I said, he's pretty busy. How about if you give me a call in 3 or 4 weeks?
But Keating was cryptic.
Maybe we can work something out then.
He instructed Damron not to bother Masters. He had too many problems to deal with.
Okay, bye.
The new show club would have to wait.
What do you got for me?
Here's the transcripts.
Damron met with Agent Brooks. Masters and Keating both appeared nervous since Diane's body had been discovered. But that was hardly enough evidence to prosecute either of them for murder. Perhaps Damron had overlooked something. He handed over his tape-recorded conversations with Keating.
This is gonna nail him. We're gonna get him.
Can you play that again, please?
Keating.
Over the next several months, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Cook County Sheriff's Department, and the FBI began the process of merging the various investigations.
All right. Well,
the link between them was Alan Masters, Cook County Lieutenant James Keating, and former Willow Springs Police Chief Michael Corbett.
If that's the case, if we can put, if we can
it would
put
fall on prosecutors to begin constructing a case proving that the three men and all of their activities represented an ongoing, organized criminal enterprise.
All right. We can get the RICO prosecution happening. That's
and what we had to do in order to prosecute Masters and Corbett and Keating for a collection of their activities, including the homicide, we had to show that they made up a criminal organization, a mini-mafia.
Appreciate you meeting with us tonight, Mrs. Campstaff.
Detective Reed and Agent Harris's first step was to question Diane's friends who had been with her on the night she disappeared.
Okay. You said that you followed her home that night.
One of Diane's colleagues, Genevieve Capstaff, had actually followed Diane home that evening after a board meeting.
And so I just wanted to see, so I followed her.
Capstaff claimed everyone on the Moraine Community College Board who worked with Diane suspected that she was having an affair with an economics professor. She admitted that she wanted to see if the two were going to rendezvous. She followed Diane to her street. When Diane turned to go home, Capstaff continued on.
Is there anything else that you can tell me?
Further questioning revealed that all of the community college board members, including Diane, were given a $100,000 life insurance policy as part of their employment benefits.
$100,000.
Right. Right. But that only covers.
The policy specifically stated that proceeds would be paid if a board member died while traveling to and from board meetings. The policy was void when the board member entered their home.
That's all, but.
We appreciate your
Alan Masters claimed Diane never arrived home that night. He was therefore eligible to collect the insurance money. Several months before Diane's body was discovered in the trunk of her car, Masters filed a claim with the insurance company. After filling out all the paperwork, he sent it off. Though Diane's fate at that time was unclear, Masters had a judge declare her legally dead. As a result, he was about to receive $100,000. Alan Masters was fast becoming the FBI's prime suspect in the murder of his wife, Diane. Shortly after her body was discovered, investigators learned that he had filed a claim with his wife's insurance company. Within a few months, two checks appeared in the amount of $50,000 each. If federal agents and prosecutors could prove Masters was responsible for his wife's death and that he profited from it, It would be one more element that showed that he and his accomplices were involved in an ongoing criminal enterprise. Homicide in a federal racketeering case carries much more jail time than a state charge. As the investigation began to take on a clearer focus, FBI agents working the undercover case received bad news.
Listen, we're going to have to move rather quickly on this.
The Washington Post had gotten word of the operation.
Listen, we're having a bit of a problem.
We're almost at the point where we can really make some impact.
The Post operation gave the FBI 3 weeks to wrap it up before running the story.
We have some have to be close down. Is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
All 16.
Agents had no choice but to quickly bring their undercover operations to a close.
We're here, so please do me a favor.
For U.S. Attorney David Stettler, the timing couldn't have been better.
The project had run its course, and the bulk of the information anybody was ever going to get had been retrieved, and to make the operation go on longer would have resulted in additional evidence, but it also would have resulted in the evidence that had been gathered becoming more and more stale.
Agents had meticulously pieced together the web of corruption that extended to the nightclubs under mob control. Now, it was time to shut them down.
Go, FBI, open the door.
The FBI hit all of the clubs on the same night with massive force. Several hundred officers and agents raided over a dozen clubs throughout Cook County, including those in Willow Springs.
Stay right here. Go on in, folks. Stay right here.
Sit tight.
Hands
behind your back.
Inside the clubs, federal agents were able to collect volumes of incriminating evidence. Fifty-five people were indicted, including club owner Joseph Marin, Tony Spilatro, and his brother Victor. They were prosecuted in both the state and federal courts for extortion, prostitution, bribery, and racketeering. Several deputies from the Cook County Sheriff's Department and officers from the Willow Springs Police Department were also indicted and convicted for protecting these businesses. After 3 years of undercover work, the sting operation was now officially closed. For undercover Special Agent Larry Damron, it was finally time to leave the role of Larry Wright.
I would say the finish was elation and disappointment at the same time. Disappointment that there were so many opportunities out there to identify other criminal activity. We knew that it was a good job, that we had gathered tremendous amounts of evidence, and that we had a real insight into some of the criminal activity that was taking place that we hadn't had before.
Alan Masters.
Local authorities, the FBI, and prosecutors could now focus exclusively on the Diane Masters murder investigation.
She said he hit her.
They continued questioning her friends and associates, including the man with whom she was allegedly having an affair.
There were other things that happened.
Economics professor Jim Koselniak.
He
confirmed that he and Diane had a relationship. He also claimed that Masters had abused Diane physically, mentally, and emotionally. She lived in fear of her husband.
Diane
had told him she planned to file for divorce. Koselniak also had reason to fear Alan Masters. One night, Koselniak and Diane had met for drinks at a local bar. He recalled that Diane called home to check on her daughter. Instead of getting the babysitter on the phone, Alan unexpectedly answered.
Alan?
He suspected she was with her lover.
I didn't know you were
He was irate and began to threaten
her. I was calling to check on Andra.
He vowed to destroy her.
What's wrong?
Kriselnyak said Diane returned from the phone call and was very upset. He went to the bar for more drinks. There, a man suddenly confronted him and began firing off a series of questions.
Yes, I did.
The man never identified himself.
10, 12 years.
What's your name?
He asked Kriselnyak's name and where he worked.
Kriselnyak.
Though the man said little else, Kriselnyak felt he had just received a threat. Stay away from Diane.
And
Kriselnyak would later recognize the man as Lieutenant James Keating. He said that on the night of Diane's disappearance, she had called him and warned him not to meet her for drinks.
So this was an unusual move on her part.
They usually got together after her college board meetings. Lately, she had been troubled by Alan's behavior. Kriselnyak took her advice and canceled their plans. He never saw Diane again. Agent Harris and Detective Reed continued to develop witnesses. They discovered that Masters had hired a private investigator to keep tabs on Diane.
We subsequently developed a cooperating individual named Ted Nakaza, who was a private investigator with Alan Masters. Masters had requested Ted Nakaza to place a bug on his home telephone number because he suspected his wife, Diane, was having an affair.
I got a few tapes.
Hey, what do you guys got for me?
Nakaza told investigators the bug was successful in exposing Diane and Kriselnyak's affair.
Not good news.
Ted Nakaza played back a telephone conversation, captured on tape, where Diane was talking in a highly sexual way with the boyfriend, Jim Kriselnyak. According to Nakaza, after playing the tape, Alan Masters declared his intention to kill Diane and to get Keating to make it look like an accident.
Alan Masters wanted his wife murdered, and he had the resources to get away with it. The FBI and local authorities continued to uncover evidence against Alan Masters and his associates that pointed towards a conspiracy to murder Alan's wife, Diane. Through a private investigator hired by Alan Masters, Diane's affair had been exposed. Alan's rage was out of control. But investigators had no hard evidence to charge him with murder. After an exhaustive five-year investigation, that was about to change.
He intended to have Diane killed.
They uncovered a Cook County Sheriff's deputy who was willing to talk.
Agent Harris.
Deputy Jack Bachman had startling information.
Keating brought me into
office. Bachman had been too afraid of the consequences of coming forward on his own. He claimed that he had been approached to kill Diane. The offer had come through Lieutenant James Keating.
Bachman had a series of conversations with Keating, and ultimately Keating asked Bachman if Bachman would be interested in the job of actually stalking and killing Diane Masters.
Bachman said Keating offered him $25,000 to carry out the hit. Michael Corbett, the chief of police, had already agreed to dispose of the body. Bachman declined the offer.
No, sir, I'm sorry. I can't get involved in anything like that. No, sir.
Through Keating, Masters had clearly solicited the murder.
About this meeting we just had.
But he did offer me $25,000.
This was one of the final pieces Prosecutor Scorza needed to bring an indictment.
He said he wanted to eliminate her. I said, what do you mean?
What we were able to show is that when Alan Masters decided to kill his wife, he simply was able to turn to the two police officers that he'd already been working with on corrupt activities and criminal activities. And that made the homicide and the planning of it and the solicitation of it, it made it an activity of the criminal enterprise.
The pieces had finally come together. Investigators put together a likely scenario of Diane Masters' murder. Alan Masters had found a hitman to kill Diane and her boyfriend when they met for the usual drinks after her college board meeting. However, Diane didn't meet with Koselniak that evening.
You're home late tonight.
The meeting ran late.
Furious, Masters took matters into his own hands.
Alan Masters was at home babysitting their young daughter. He was setting up his alibi by making long-distance calls all night to prove that he was home. He never expected his wife to walk in the door. She did. She began the process of getting undressed, and he hit her with a blunt instrument, two blows to the head.
Masters then called Chief Corbett, who came with an unknown accomplice to dispose of the body. They dumped Diane's body in the trunk of her Cadillac. Corbett then drove away with the accomplice following him. Masters remained at home with his daughter. They drove to the remote sanitary canal. Diane's watch was reset to throw investigators off the trail should her body ever be found. They then fired two shots into her head. They wanted it to look like a mob hit. They also reset the dashboard clock to 1:50. Alan Masters made sure that he was on the phone at the time to corroborate his alibi. Corbett and the accomplice dumped the Cadillac into the canal. In June of 1988, 6 years after Diane's murder, investigators brought charges against the three conspirators. Former police chief Michael Corbett was the first arrested on federal charges of racketeering, bribery, and conspiracy to solicit and cover up the murder of Diane Masters. Special Agent Ivan Harris tried to elicit a confession.
Mike Corbett subsequently confessed that he was, in fact, the person that had put Diane Masters' car in the canal. He disavowed any knowledge knowing that she was in the trunk of the car at that time.
Cook County Lieutenant James Keating was arrested next on the same federal charges. He, too, denied involvement in Diane's murder. And finally, Alan Masters. In addition to racketeering and bribery, the indictment against Alan Masters charged that he planned, solicited, and aided and abetted the murder of his wife. Prosecutors would not have enough hard evidence to charge any of the conspirators with the actual murder of Diane. Prosecutor Tom Scorza was able to successfully tie all of their criminal activities together for the jury. Masters was convicted on all counts. Collecting the $100,000 insurance money after having his wife murdered also made him guilty of mail fraud. He received a total of 40 years, effectively, to the end of his life. Former Chief Michael Corbett received 20 years. James Keating was convicted and sentenced to over 30 years.
The Masters case was special in my experience because there was no one single piece of evidence proving guilt. What there were 1,000 little pieces that made a mosaic. That was made the case intriguing. It made it very difficult to present. It made it a challenge to present to the jury. But it made a terrific story because in the end, the jury could see how one little piece from over here and one little piece from over there made a picture. And the picture was a plot among three fellows who had been involved in a lot of criminal activity to do their ultimate criminal act, murder Diane Masters.
Watch yourself.
The undercover investigation that Agent Damron oversaw, and the work of several other FBI agents, exposed a deeply rooted corruption throughout Cook County and brought it to its ultimate demise. By weeding out these pockets of corruption, the people living in the suburbs of Chicago no longer have to live with the lawlessness that threatened to destroy their community.